is how to survive in a hostile environment. And I'll just start with one of my experiences. When I was getting my PhD, I was teaching at Chico State, and I went down to UC Santa Barbara for the defense of my PhD dissertation, the oral exam. And we went around the room, and all the professors asked me questions, and I had the answers, no problem. And then we came to a history professor who was outside of my department, and he said, I don't have any questions for you. I think you need to do more work. So he gave me a bunch of busy work to do that I never used in the finished book. And then later on, he wrote to me, and he said, I really had an uncomfortable time with thinking about women getting into academia. So there's kind of a fraternity spirit of hazing, and I guess he had to haze me to make sure that I had the perseverance to jump through the hoops. So, Amasha, let's start with you. I'd like to let listeners know that at Chico State, African Americans like yourself are only 2% of the student population. And I know that you grew up in Oakland, which is much more diverse. I wonder what it's been like being a beautiful African American woman at a predominantly white institution.
Hmm. It's definitely been tough. I think that I completely took Oakland for granted, and I thought that diversity was something that came naturally until I came here, and I was kind of shell-shocked. I wasn't really super aware of my blackness growing up. You know, I was black, I liked to hike, I was a vegetarian, and, you know, it was just kind of like a casual part of my identity. But when I came to Chico State, it seemed like that was like only me. Every time I walk into a space or a classroom, I'm usually the only brown person, which is saying a lot there. And it's just, I'm completely limited to what I look like, and then a whole bunch of characteristics come along with that. And
like, what kind of characteristics? Oh. What do people assume about you because of your skin color?
Ghetto. Usually it's about like my interests. I'm an artistic person. I love music, I love fashion, I love everything. But usually it's like, oh, you know, you came from an inner city. It's mostly usually just based on like the experiences that I've had. People make judgments on what I've gone through or things like that. Yeah.
What was it like living in the dorms?
Oh, it was terrible. I lived in Whitney, which is a 9-story building. A lot of students there, probably more than 1,000. And I was the only black person there. And I remember, even when I would be coming upstairs trying to get to my room, I would want to take the elevator. There was 2 elevators. Say I would want to go into one, people would quickly try to close the doors so I wouldn't go into the one that the white people were in, and I would have to go into another one by myself. So it was that casual isolation. It's not always super blatant or explicit, but those small things really build up and make you feel like an outsider.
Do you think they were afraid they were going to get brown or get cooties or what? I don't understand what the non-logic of that non-logic is.
Get brown, definitely. It's contagious. I'm not sure. I think it's based on lack of exposure.
A lot of people from Chico State are from small towns in Northern California, farming towns, agriculture, you know, mostly filled with white people. And when they are exposed to black people or black culture, it's, you know, what you see on the TV. It's stereotypical. I don't think they really know. So I don't know. Also, being in Chico has forced me to be kind of more understanding, even though that might sound bad, being understanding of racism and why people have these perceived notions of who I am.
And weren't you on a dance team with, yeah, were you the only person of color on that?
No, I was actually in a black dance team. So yeah, Chico is, it's kind of been a space of contradiction for me, because even in white spaces, you know, obviously for the way I look, I'm not accepted. But even when I come into black spaces here, I'm not always accepted either, because I don't play into their ideas of what it is to be a black woman. So, and that,
what might that be?
The same things I was talking about, like, you know, just your stereotypical your stereotypical black woman, I guess. I don't know, coming from Oakland and with my you know, my parents are hippies, and I've just had a very different experience, and I'm all for I think that being black is so dimensional, and black expression comes in many different ways, but I feel like in some spaces it's just limited.
Were you able to speak to anyone in authority in Chico State about this? Like, I know I emailed the president and said you should talk to Amasha before she leaves. Did you hear from her?
No, I didn't.
Did you hear from anybody?
No, I haven't. I don't think these are the issues that matter the most here, you know, in their eyes.
What do you think matters to them?
Keeping the majority happy. If you look at Chico State, it's even though they do preach diversity, it's almost 100% white. We do have a beautiful Latinx community, which is great, but culturally it is white. So we want to appeal to the people who are coming to Chico State, who are putting money into Chico State. Yeah.
Just the breakdown of students, Hispanic, this was in 2015, 29%, Asian, 7%, mixed, 5%, white, 46%, 53% female. So you were in the majority there.
All right. That's good.
let's come back. Mike, you grew up in a kind of a different family, a Mexican-American family in Chico.
Yeah.
And the stereotype, like in movies like Fools Rush In, is Mexican-American Chicano families are a lot of interaction. They get together often. They support each other. And was that your experience, that you had a big extended family that was supporting you?
No, we didn't have a big family. Our family is basically isolated from everybody else, from everybody, like the rest of our family that lives in Mexico and in Texas. We pretty much isolated ourselves from everybody, you know. My father was a hardworking man, but he was involved with drugs. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom who pretty much did everything my dad said, you know. He basically taught us, you know, like the man has this hearsay. I mean, does what he wants, basically, you know. And I grew up just thinking differently. Like, it's my, I don't know, it's, it was very difficult for me growing up.
What was difficult?
I didn't have no structure, you know. I didn't have to go to school. My dad would bring bad people over, you know. I lived in a drug house, basically. And I had to hide that from all my peers in school, you know. And it was really hard, like, separating both lives, you know. I'd go home and like I'd get picked on. I'd get bullied by my brothers. My mother paid no attention to me at all. She was so worried about what my dad was doing and what my older brothers were doing because they were following my dad's footsteps, you know. So I never really got attention, you know. And like going to school, I didn't really know how to like socialize with my own age. So I started looking for the older people. Like all my brother's friends, their lifestyles would appeal to me because that's all I knew. You know, everything that was going on in my house, like I'd have to hide at school with my friends. But if I go to the older crowd, like I didn't have to hide. You know, I'd hear my dad say certain things, and I'd go to them, and I could, you know, I could seem cool. You know, like I know what this is, and I know what that is. You know, it's drinking beer and at a very young age and doing drugs. You know, so it was. You know, now thinking about it now and having a daughter of my own, like that was very difficult to do, to separate both lives growing up like that. So
you you dropped out of school in eighth grade?
Ninth grade.
Ninth grade. Yeah. And why?
Drugs.
What, I don't understand.
Well, let me see. So I started fantasizing about drugs that are like at 9 years old. I started smoking weed at nine. I started doing narcotics at nine. I didn't see what school was so important, you know. I'd go there, I'd get in trouble, or I'd go there to sleep, or I'd go there to...
To sleep?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't get much, you know. My whole thing was I'm going to party with my friends till early morning and then go to sleep, you know. And I don't know, that fast lifestyle appealed to me. You know, my dad, I loved my dad. he passed away about 7 years ago. I loved him dearly. I didn't realize that what bad influence he was on me, because I wanted to be just like him.
Sure, he's your male role model.
And I grew up just like him, you know? Well, till like 4 or 5 years ago, you know, actually. Thank God I grew out of that.
So did your dad go to prison for the drug offenses?
Yes, yes. His last 10 years of his life, he did 5 years in prison, got out with cancer, and then passed away.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah. And then how old were you when you first went to prison?
I was 18.
And what was that like? Tell us about prison.
Well, first and foremost, I had to join a gang, basically. You know, and I mean, I went to county, and it was like, I was already associated with a gang, but I wasn't like enrolled or, you know, like I wasn't a gang member.
And were they your brother's friends?
No, they were my own friends. Oh. They weren't a part of that. But I found out quickly, you know, as soon as you get housed, like every group segment will come and ask you who you are.
What gang?
Yeah, what gang or who you are. I'm Mexican, but I grew up here, so I'm like, I mean, everybody sees me as a whitewashed Mexican, you know. So I didn't really know, and then I got pulled aside by the Mexican gang or whatever. I'm not going to really say what it was, but and they kind of just they told me all about it, you know, and like, you're not going to survive unless you're in something, you know. You can't just be a number, a statistic, you know. You can't
an individual.
You can't be an individual. You cannot, you know. It's not going to happen.
Will you get beat up, or what would happen?
You'd get taken advantage of in various ways. You know, everyone's going to try and take advantage of you. You know, I wouldn't say necessarily getting beat up, but a lot of people, they're going to misguide you and things that... There's a lot of politics, obviously, in prison, you know, and, like, not knowing what to expect or what to do when a situation arises, what are you going to do? You're going to set yourself up for failure, and that's when the bad stuff starts happening. So having a gang, having, you know, a group of friends that help you out is what they call it. You know, what's the point? I mean, that's what enticed me.
Right.
You know, I don't want to, it's my first time in prison. I'm scared. I don't,
sure.
You know, it doesn't matter how tough you are. That first bus ride to prison is the scariest, was the scariest time of my life. You know, and.
It's not okay to have friends, like, who are Anglo or black. You can only, like, hang out with Chicanos in prison, or.
No, you can hang out with anybody. You just can't eat off of anybody. You know, like, We can't eat off of white people, basically. We segregate Caucasians. You know, we can't sit in the same table, and we can't eat after them. You know, basically.
You mean you can't eat with them?
With them or off them? They can't offer you any food. It's like totally hands off. You know, coming from a life where all my friends are white. You know, a lot of them were Mexican, but most of them were white. It was very difficult for me. You know, and. Like, just knowing that, you know, bad things will happen if you do that, if you get caught doing that, you know. It's like a total, like, no-no.
Right. What I've heard is that women prisons, they organize as families. There's, like, the mom and the baby and the older sister and
two
that
wives.
Kind of thing. And in men's prisons, it's a hierarchy.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not like a family. It's like, this is the boss, this is the second boss. Is that...
Oh yeah,
accurate?
Yeah. Oh, totally accurate. And then you got your shoulders, and it goes all the way from the shoulders all the way up to the top that people are calling the shots. So
it's like a military hierarchy. It's
completely the group that I was with, we're like the more structured group in prison. Our rules are just very intense. You know, mandatory workouts, waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning, not nap. You can't take a nap. I mean, you have to do your time. You know, you don't sleep all day. You work out and. You actually get educated in policies of our cause and our struggles and why we fight for what we think is fair. And it's, you know, it's just thinking about it with all the drugs and the just ignorance, it's actually a pretty good structure. Back when it first started, there was a reason for it, you know. And
it's like survival.
It's survival, but we do it for a reason. So our people we used to get bullied by everybody else until one day somebody decided to start this gang up, and it's from they're called all the farmers is what we are, you know, people from up north, and we all joined together and became the farmers, you know. And I mean, back, like I said, back when it first started, it was great. The structure was great, but it just drugs and money and drugs and money and popularity contest is what I'm looking for. You know, everybody wants to be the top dog. Everybody
is
wants
it based
to be,
on more than strength?
Yeah.
So if you're a cool, nice person, you could be.
Well, if you're a cool, nice person, but if you're too nice, someone's not gonna like you.
Right.
Someone's gonna smut you up. It's what's gonna happen. You know, and it's basically everybody there just puts on a show.
Of strength.
You know, it's pretty sad because I spend a lot of time in there, and not one day in my life was I myself. You know, I'm like the coolest, more laid back guy.
Right.
No, but in there, it's like you got to put on this front, and you got your tattoos, and you got to be the biggest guy in the yard, and you got to talk tough, and it's like, that's not who I am, you know what I mean? I may look tough, I don't know if I got tattoos, but honestly, inside, I'm a nice guy, you know? Without the drugs and the alcohol, just me being sober, I'm a nice guy. You start mixing in the drugs and alcohol and the gangs, and it changes a person, you know? And you don't necessarily change to... like be cool, or just you change to fit in for the next man to say, oh, that guy's tough, or that guy, you know, that guy's with it, you know, that guy's, you know, he can do some damage. But in reality, most of the people there are fake, you know. It's just a front. It's just to look the part, you know.
I'm thinking of like chimpanzees when the alpha males puff up their or the dogs puff up their hair on their neck to look big.
Yeah,
so it's kind of like a primate posturing or something. So it sounds like your coping technique was to join a group and conform to the group and put up a actor's veneer of I'm strong, don't mess with me.
Yep, that's exactly it.
So then what happens when you get out and you've built up all this shell and this, how do you relate to women and your family? I mean, because it's hard to just go, now I'm soft and gentle and nice.
It doesn't shut off. That mentality doesn't shut off. It's called being institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a lot of good traits that I learned by being in there, like cleanliness and like being like having a set schedule and being on time and like
that discipline.
Was exactly that was a good part because I didn't have any of that. But like all the other stuff that puffing up when someone looks at you wrong and making sure that he knows that I saw that and like I'm gonna confront him on it and like when in reality. Like, people are going to look. You have a bunch of tattoos all over your body. Like, people, I mean, like, that's the reality of it. And they're not necessarily being rude. They're going to look, you know? And then, like, when you're locked up, like, you see somebody looking at you crazy, like, you gotta do something about it or else, you know, you're weak, you know? And that was, like, a big part of me trying to shut it off and being sweet and compassionate and loving. I mean, like, my wife knows. I mean, like, every time when I got out, like, it was... I needed a little bit of time to just kind of just let that stuff go, you know?
Absolutely. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Art, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Art has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festive and events, including Oktoberfest, Chico Palo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. Ask Dr. Gale is also brought to you by Burchard Construction, specializing in custom remodels, new home, and commercial building from foundation to finish work. Burchard Construction, where the homeowner's input matters to ensure a professional, reliable, and quality result. Custom construction with beauty and function. For bids and consultations, call Adam Burchard at 864-5427 or visit burchardconstruction.com. And I'd also like to mention that the Lyme Council, people who have Lyme's disease from those insidious little wicked ticks, are doing a benefit on Sunday, May 21st at the Chico Women's Club. It's from 4 to 7 p.m., and it's an evening of music and information about Lyme's. And Bird and Wag and Mossy Creek are going to play. So you're listening to KZFR FM, Chico, and North State and beyond. So, Amasha, I want to get back to surviving in an institution for you. I interviewed a young African-American woman at Georgetown University, and she said she was always expected to be like the black spokesperson. If something comes up in class, well, how do you tell us about Black Lives Matter or whatever? Mm-hmm. And you're always kind of under scrutiny in a predominantly white institution, which she called a PWI. Mm-hmm. And what works for her, she said, is they have a multicultural center. And she said, you can go there and you can take off your armor, you can relax, you don't have to explain yourself. And I wondered if there's anything like that for you at Chico State. It's interesting that both you and Mike have to do this armoring thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in different ways. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, we have a cross-cultural leadership center on campus. I work there. I found it my second semester. This is my second year now, but my second semester as a freshman, I was so depressed my first semester, and I was like, I need to find a place where I can just be myself. And I found the center. I just was kind of observing people, and I saw all the brown people, like, walking into this one room. Yeah, and I was like, what? Is this a cave? Like, what is going on? So I just came in there one day, introduced myself, and then I was just hanging out in there, just sitting there talking to people day after day after day. And then when it came time to apply, to get involved, directly involved, I signed up, I got the job. So now I really try to make sure that other students are not feeling as isolated as I felt, or if I see a brown person on campus, I'm like, do you know that the Cross-Cultural Leadership Center exists? Because most people don't know it's even out there. I try to bring them in. Yeah.
And so is that true that you become the black person that people look to for explanations, mm-hmm, and education and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it happens a lot, and I do have to play that role, which is, I don't always like being that person. But yeah, I was just talking to my friend, actually. I remember it was last year, you know, during the peak of like Black Lives Matter. It was in my like political science class, and the professor was like, okay, who knows what Black Lives Matter is? And, you know, everyone, the whole class, kind of just inverted and just, like, looked at me. And I'm like, I literally kind of screamed. I was like, it just means don't kill black people. That's, like, literally all it means. I wasn't willing to really explain things. I'm just like, that's the point, whatever. 'Cause being, even though I love activism and I love speaking for my people, being forced into that role is, I'm a person, you know. You know, I'm not just, like, black people, all the time. Being forced to do that all the time, it gets like repetitive and limiting. Yeah,
I think one of the ways you cope is by humor. And I know one of your ambitions in life is to do some stand-up. So could I twist your arm to do a little bit of stand-up for us?
Yes.
Sit down.
Sit down. Yes, I'll do a little bit. Should I just transition into that right now?
Please.
Okay.
We're laughing already.
We're laughing. Okay. All right. So I'm transferring out of Chico State. And I will say the main reason why I am leaving is because I can't swim here. And I can't attend the gym. I was there last Thursday, you know, swimming, trying to get some exercise. And I see one of my white peers. And he comes up. And he's like, oh, you know how to swim? Okay, that first question might not have been racist because I was choking while at that specific moment, but the question started getting more specific to my race, and he was like, oh, you're just going to let your hair get wet like that? Isn't your weave going to melt? And then he was like, oh, how do you know how to swim in the first place? I'm assuming your dad was in there to teach you. Just really?
That's the truth? This is not a joke, right?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
So then I'm like, all right, it's time to get out the pool. Obviously, this is not my space. There's not enough brown people here for me to. There's a lot of stigma between black people and water, you know, so it's not always the most comfortable. So I'm trying to leave, and this other white guy comes up, and his approach is a little bit different. He's like hitting on me, and he's like, oh, wow, I really love that dirt brown complexion of your skin, and wow, your hair just looks like cute little spiders. And I'm like, all right, I'm officially leaving this area. So I'm like, okay, let me go dance. So I go upstairs to the rec, and there's like empty rooms. I'm with my friend, I'm trying to get a room to go dance, and I see these white girls crumping to country music. They were really trying really hard. They were all in unison. I was really distraught by the sight. So I'm like, all right, let me just leave the gym right now. Let me just go home. So I hop on my bike. But it doesn't take, I can't even get home. I'm not even on my, in motion for long before I see a white girl having a photo shoot in the middle of the street. You know, her legs are apart. She's like standing upright. She's looking into the camera, really sultry, pretty typical for graduation photos. And I'm like, okay, these types of Caucasian middle of the road photo shoots must be like the major cause of traffic jams in this country. So, yeah, that was my Thursday. That was 1 hour at the gym. And that pretty much encapsulates like my experience here as a brown and black person in Chico.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where next?
So I'm going to move back to the Bay. I'm going to transfer to SF State. Yeah, see how I like it. If I enjoy it, I'll stay there. If not, the world is my oyster.
That's true.
Yeah.
You were student body president at your high school.
I know.
Yeah. Was that normal for girls to be president, or were there more? What was the gender kind of history of that kind of leadership in your high school?
Probably traditionally it wasn't, you know, women doing it, but there was actually a trend of black women being the student body president before me was a black woman, and so I don't know, I didn't feel too weird in that position, except sometimes, like, I went to a private Catholic school, the white faculty would kind of like talk down to me, and I remember they would assume I didn't know certain words. Oh, there's this one word, pretentious. This one like faculty member said, like, she used the word pretentious, and she said, oh, you probably don't know what that means, or something like
that's
that.
Patronizing.
Yes, and then I like used another word. I don't remember what I did, but I flipped it back on her, and I was like, you don't know what that word is. So that's how I survived. I just kind of, whatever they gave me, I just flipped it back. Yeah.
Right. What was the issue that you were most proud of addressing as student body president?
Oh.
What I've heard in Chico is the student leadership is kind of like a pep club. Mm-hmm. Rah-rah, go to support the football players. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you addressed any kind of educational or student real issues.
I'd say the main issue that I saw at my school was segregation. It's in Oakland, you know, you don't really assume that, but it was a private Catholic school, so the white people hung out with the white people and the black people hung out with the black people. And I had a white boyfriend at the time, and I remember it was like prom season, and there was like two prom buses. There was the white prom bus, and there was the black prom bus.
No.
Yeah, I'm serious.
No.
And so I had a white boyfriend, so I went on the white prom bus, and I was all dressed up. You know, it's a special day. I was on the bus, and it was like really boring in there, you know. And they're like, oh, Amasha, you're the only black person here. You need to dance right now. You need to start dancing. And this one white dude starts throwing money at me.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I'm literally just sitting still, just being like a normal person. So that situation that I got myself in kind of like drew me to really address the segregation. Of course, I was like 16 at this time. I really wasn't aware of the reasons why people thought these different ways. But I did try to use humor to kind of like bridge the gaps and I don't know, just like casually let people know like this is not okay, this is okay, things like that.
I'm really interested in youth-led activism because like under Trump there's so much work to be done, and it seems that the most active youth-led activism are the Dreamers, Black Lives Matter, the Dakota Pipeline, mm-hmm. DAP. Is there some kind of obvious or not so obvious reason why young people of color are the leaders in these kinds of causes for justice?
Well, actually, we were having a conversation in my English class today, and the professor was like, oh, do you guys pay attention to politics? Are you guys keeping up with Trump's administration? I'm the only black person. I shouldn't even be saying that anymore, but everyone's okay. Like, no, you know, I don't really care. It's finals, you know. And I saw a stark contrast because me, I don't have a choice to ignore politics, or any person of color doesn't have that choice. That's a privilege that they have. So I think we are being forced to speak up, which is beautiful, but we are being forced to because our livelihood is being threatened on a daily basis.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there a Black Lives Matter group in Chico, a Dreamers group. I think there's a Idle No More, the Native Indigenous group that was formed in Canada. I think there's a chapter in the area. Mm. Do you know of any that are local?
I don't think there's a Black Lives Matter chapter here. The population is so small that it's really hard to build up momentum, but we do have a lot of things going on through the Cross Culture Leadership Center on campus, and we put on different protests and things like that. Yeah.
Mike, you had a long history of using drugs. So it takes a lot of strength and courage to get off, and I know that you are now. And I wondered how you got clean.
Well, after many years of trying. actually, my last stay at rehab, something clicked. I was, well, referring back to the gang I was involved in, like, we couldn't use drugs in prison. Like, it's against rules and policies, so. Like,
of the gang.
The gang, not, yeah. The gang, out when you're incarcerated. So every time I was in prison, like, I didn't use drugs. I was clean. You know, life was great, except for the part that I was locked up, you know. But I was clear-headed. So I always had so many dreams and visions of my whole life. That's what I'm going to do when I get out. And then I'd get out, and then, you know, you meet the wrong person. You're in a fight with just having a bad day. And, like, my coping skills is using drugs to numb it. So my last stint in rehab, like, it just dawned on me that if I could stay clean for people that don't mean anything to me, I mean, they do, they're my friends, but they're not family, they're not my wife, they're not my daughter, you know, they don't truly love me, you know, unconditionally. If I could stay clean for them, how in the heck can I not stay clean for the people that are there for me?
Mm.
That, because, I mean, when I do time, they do time, you know, because my wife and my kids, they've always waited for me, you know. I got out, and, like, my family started back up. So that was my big epiphany, and I said, you know what, I'm going to reverse it. If I ever go to prison again, I'm going to get high, but I'm going to stay clean out here. And it worked, you know, and I did the geographical move. I moved up to Magalia, and I got a new job. I started from the bottom, but, I mean, my life is great now, you know. And, like, just those three things that I changed, which basically everything, you know.
Your friends.
I don't really necessarily associate with a lot of people, you know. Not living in Chico has changed my life. I mean, from enemies to friends to the police, like, I knew them all. You know, I couldn't walk down the street without getting pulled over or getting off for drugs or getting in a fight.
Wow.
You know, that's just the way it was. You know, it's my stomping ground, you know. And, like, it was tough trying to stay clean out here, you know. Like, really trying, and, like, really not trying to lie to my wife, and really not trying to let down my daughter, and really not trying to lose my job. Like, really not trying to do it. It just kind of happened. Like, it. After so many times of it being shoved in your face, you finally say, F it. You know, I'm just, you know, you're so used to it, you know. And
did you get any skills in rehab that you didn't have before in terms of coping with stress?
No, you know, like, I mean, everything I did basically to tell you not to do. You know, if you move out of town, you're going to find a drug connection there. And if you do this, and I did all that, you know. I think I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired, and that's a saying that they use a lot, you know. And I know all the NA slang, and, like, I could talk the talk, but I just kind of followed my heart, you know, and it all kind of just slowly came together, you know. It didn't happen overnight, you know, and I still battle with not necessarily addiction, but just learning how to cope with when things go wrong, and, you know, it's difficult, you know. It's difficult not having anything to numb yourself and to hide, and, you know, my whole. Like, I love numbing myself. I hate feeling depressed. I hate feeling sad. I'm learning now how to, like deal with it. But, I mean, like, I really don't know. Like, I don't know how normal people do it. Like, I get loaded, you know? Like, that's what I do. But
what you did do.
Oh, I did. That's what I did do.
What do you do now?
I work a lot.
You stay busy.
I went from a drug addict to a workaholic. No, I work a lot, and I just go home and try to spend as much time with my family. I mean, I do work a lot, so I know right now I'm not spending too much time with them, but it's all for a reason. Like, there's like, I have little mini goals that I mean, my goals are what keep me going, you know. I have big goals and mini goals, and I just try and really keep focus on what's coming up next, you know. I don't necessarily live in the moment. I just, I have, I see my future now, you know, and I see it bright, and I see good things coming my way and my family's way if I continue on the same road, because I'm just a line, a syringe, a whatever away from just going back to what I used to be.
Mm.
You know, and this last time they were trying to give me a lot of time in prison, and by the grace of whoever's watching me, whoever's looking over me, I got a chance for my life again, you know.
And to go to rehab.
To go to rehab and be on drug court. And, like, I was in drug court for 5 years, but that is the hardest program any drug addict could ever go through. And I successfully...
They test your urine, or what is the name, drug court?
Yeah, it's a highly structured program for drug addicts, as myself. I mean, I tested... In the period of almost 5 years, I've tested 558 times.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is going into a bathroom with another guy, pulling my pants down, having him do the whole little ballerina dance, and then peeing in front of him. The hardest thing I could ever do. I don't mind being naked in front of people. Like, that isn't... But peeing next to a guy, another man watching you, like, was the hardest thing to do. And I did it...
It's hard for anybody to
558 times.
Someone watching you.
Yeah, and I couldn't go. And if you can't go, you're dirty.
Oh.
What do you mean I'm dirty? Well, you're a drug addict, so you must be dirty. You know, it was the same fight 3 times a week.
Oh, boy.
Well, I can't go. Well, how come you can't go? Well, I work construction. I sweat all day long. I drank probably like 5 gallons of water before I came here. I sweat it all out. I can't go. And then the whole thing, well, why is your pee so diluted? I'm working. I drink a lot of water. I'm hydrating. Well, you're dirty.
Oh. So
that was probably the hardest thing. It wasn't staying clean. It was peeing in front of that one guy.
Was it the same one all the time, or it was different?
Three
ones?
Different guys.
Three different guys.
Yeah, I actually invited the guy for my graduation, my graduation thing at court. When they successfully discharged me, I told him I wanted him to be there because, I mean, that must be a tough job.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
Nobody's happy with that.
Yeah,
job.
No, we both hate it. We're looking at each other. It's like, you got to do it. I'm like, well, quit watching me, dude. Yeah, it was tough.
Do you know anybody who's undocumented? I'm wondering what you're hearing about the Trump influence on Mexicans who are undocumented, who live in the area.
Yeah, most of the people at work, I mean, no one's saying anything. I haven't really asked them or anything. You know, I haven't heard any negative things. Or
they're undocumented, but don't seem afraid.
They don't seem afraid at all. I mean, maybe because they're comfortable with what they've been doing for this long, you know. So I don't know.
Do you know undocumented students at Chico State, and
yeah.
How are they coping? Because they have DACA that
mm-hmm.
we're not sure if Trump is going to let stand or not. Right?
Yeah. Around time of the election, it was a really, really dark place where I work. We had to kind of shut the center down and just hold it open as a space for people to come and cry and talk about their family. And even now, some weekends I hear my friends will text me like, oh, ICE is in the neighborhood, keep watch. Or they'll we text each other like the list of rights that you do have if ICE were to come to you. So
what are those rights for people who don't know? If ICE says, let me see your papers, let me see your driver's license, whatever, what can you say?
Not sure. I think you can start off with saying like, I have the right to not show you this, or yeah, but I don't really know, fortunately.
I know they've already deported the first DACA young
that.
Man.
Yeah,
yeah. So there's no rhyme or reason to it, as far as I can see.
No, I think it's all a symbol. I think it's just like, I don't like white supremacy, and you know, like, hey guys, you know, you don't belong here, and we can do whatever we want to you at any point in time. So.
I read a really interesting article that said the photo ops of Trump signing his obnoxious executive orders and the health bill, they're all white males.
Mm-hmm.
And the article suggested that it's on purpose. You know, they want to make a statement that white male supremacy is back under the alpha male.
Yeah.
That's really freaky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing that the health bill in the Senate, the committee that's looking at it, is all white males. And so they're comfortable saying what, at least in the House, that you don't have to cover maternity or pediatrics or pre-existing conditions. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about a recent survey that UCLA does every year. They have a foundation that studies college first-year students. And they found that the young women are much more liberal than the men. That women, 41% said they were liberal compared to only 29% of the men. These are around the country, fresh people, or what the Brits say, freshers, rather than freshmen. And women were more likely to advocate climate change should be a government priority, 82% to 78%. To advocate stricter gun control laws, 75% versus 59%. I mean, these are big differences. Yeah. They're not a few. And as a young woman, I wondered if you have any explanation of why young women are so much more liberal.
My first thought would be just like a woman's intuition. We are in tune with the universe. We are in tune with what is right in terms of like global warming. We care about the environment. But also women, being a black woman, I am intersexually impressed. You know, I'm both black and I'm a woman, but when you're a woman, you're being directly affected by all these birth control or abortion bills and all this. Like, it's easy for a guy to say, yeah, okay, abortion not legal. Yeah, we're going to tax birth control, because they're not living that experience. It's just lack of, it's ignorance. Yeah.
It does take two to tango. I mean, birth control and abortion, the result of a male and female.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. They just pin it all on the women. So it's just the women trying to resist, trying to speak out. I think there needs to be more women in the White House, more women in politics.
Well, yeah. To me, that's the beauty of Trump, if there is any beauty. The silver lining is that a lot more women are running for office. People are angry. People are talking about these issues. And I'm wondering if the reason these statistics were from last year and Trump was in the news all the time. So I wonder if Trump is in some ways driving this, that women are offended by the I can grab your genitalia if I feel like it because I'm a star. I mean, that's so it's offensive to anybody, right, Mike, that anybody would speak like that.
Yeah.
So, but we personally can feel what it would be like to have that happen. So I'm wondering what you think the Trump effect is.
I will not go as far to say that I think Trump is a good thing, but he is waking people up. All of these systems have been in control since the dawn of America, and I think now, and I'm beginning to wonder if it's intentionally, but now it's becoming explicit. It's becoming loud and clear. His administration is completely, you can see inside of it. You know what's going on. He just fired the FBI director. Like, you can pretty much see everything he's doing, and everyone is paying attention to it. So now people are talking about it. People are waking up. People, white liberals who really didn't pay attention to racism before, are like, wow, okay, black lives do matter and things like that. So, I mean, I think if Hillary were president, a lot of these things would have continued to be ignored.
Right.
Yeah.
That's my thinking, is that there is a silver lining, that people are activists that they wouldn't be in a way if Clinton was in.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
Good stuff is coming out of it. Mike, do you pay more attention to politics with Trump, or are you too busy?
No, I really don't. I don't necessarily agree with the negative things that Trump is doing, but I don't know too much, you know. I don't necessarily feel like, you know, he's like the worst thing that happened. I personally wouldn't have voted for Hillary myself.
Why?
I don't know. I just, like I said, I don't want to get too much into it because I don't know too much. I don't want to sound like I'm either arguing or I'm standing up for something I really don't pay too much attention to. Those are just my beliefs and what I do know. I mean,
what bothered you about her that made you think I
think she's just not the most honest person myself. I mean, like, that's all I can, like, you can pretty much tell a lot about a person by just the few couple of seconds, even if it's on TV. And she just seems like she's, it's more of like the fame for her and like her destiny to be the president at any cost. That's the way I view her, you know. Again, I don't want to offend anybody or anything, but like, you know, like, which one's the better of the two? I don't know. I mean, like, who did I vote for? I didn't vote for any of them. You know, could I vote? No, I couldn't. I'm a felon. You know, I don't have a right to vote.
But ever? Can you, appeal that?
I think after a while, I'm not too sure how long it's for, but I can't vote.
Wow.
So, but I mean, like you guys were talking about, like, you know, good things are coming out of Trump being president, you know, vice versa. What would have happened if Hillary was president? You know, you're going to have a bunch of other people that are just mad at that she's president because she's a woman and because of other things, you know? So there's just like, you know, either way, things are happening that nobody expected. You know, a woman being president, a black president with Obama, like, you know, things are changing. Life's changing. The world's changing, you know? I think everybody needs to just be a little more open and just kind of, you know, hope and pray for that everything works out for the best and nobody suffers any consequences. And like the whole immigration things, like hopefully he's not going overboard with it, and hopefully innocent people don't get sent back that are actually, trying to get papers and trying to get paying taxes and not working the system. Because I, you know, it's like, you know, it's which side is better, you know? Like, are we gonna pay for these people to live here for free and pay their way? Or are we going to, you know, the people that are taking advantage of that, or are we going to help the people that are actually trying to live a better life and, you know, that are trying, they're sending money to Mexico? And, like, there's, like, always two sides of the coin, you know what I mean? Which one's worse? I don't know. I'm not living that lifestyle, so I personally can't necessarily be like, well, that's wrong and that's right, because, you know, unless it happens to you, you know exactly what's going on, you know? I think anybody who's coming over here and doing really bad things, like, yeah, they shouldn't be given a second chance. I personally know a couple of my friends that repeatedly offended selling drugs to, you know, by schools and, like, doing things you know, and, like, well, they got their papers taken away and they got sent to Mexico. And do I feel bad for them? No. They shouldn't have been over here feeding drugs to our children.
Right.
I was one of those kids. You know, those older kids and those drug dealers, they shouldn't have been. I was a 13-year-old boy. You know, so I have less sympathy for those situations, mm-hmm. as to like some other ones, like, I can't really speak too much of, you know,
mm-hmm.
but like, I mean, I wish I could get on more political, but I don't really know too much. Those are just,
no, you made that clear. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Pearson Road Collision Repair, independent and certified with over 30 years experience. Pearson Road Collision Repair handles insurance claims with skilled technicians at 119 Pearson Road in Paradise. And Old Ride Side Auto Restoration, turning your dream car into reality. More information by calling 872-5627 or at PearsonRoadCollisionRepair.com. Ask Dr. Gale at KZFR Chico is also brought to you by the Yoga Center of Chico. Longtime yogis Tom Hess, who's my teacher, and Rex Stromness have created a yoga center dedicated to yoga and holistic healing. They offer workshops, retreats, private sessions, massage, and both day and evening classes. For more information about the Yoga Center of Chico, located at 250 Vallambrosia Avenue, Suite 150, next to T-Bar, call 342-0100 or visit yogacenterofchico.com. And I'd like to remind you that the Limes benefit and education event is May 21st from 4 to 7 p.m. And Ask Dr. Gale is the second Thursday of each month. I'm really open to your suggestion for topics. And you can contact me at gkimball@csuchico.edu. It's gkimball at csuchico.edu. I'm keep changing topics, but I'm really interested too, Amasha, in what happens with addiction, since we're kind of on that topic, to electronic devices. I read an article by a professor who said that he couldn't understand why one of his really good students kept looking down. And so he realized she had her cell phone in her purse, and she was checking her messages during class. And I've seen photographs of big college lectures, and their computers are up. And if you look, it's on Facebook, it's mm-hmm. on games, it's on video games and stuff. Do you see that there's a ubiquitous kind of addiction to electronic devices?
Of course.
Yes. I have a couple of theories, well, ideas of why I think. First one is isolation. We are all alone, you know, in some way. And when you look at your phone and you see that your friend is texting you or you post a picture, I know personally, like sometimes if I'm feeling sad, I will post a picture of myself and then I'll get a lot of likes. And then I'm like, whew, I'm no longer sad. So It's that like immediate gratification that social media and the phone, it's bright. Your eyes get excited. It's just like kind of like human nature to be gravitated towards that. And then in terms of class, you know, stuff gets boring sometimes, and then you just need a little, it kind of just like, I don't know, it's, people are addicted, like studies have shown people are addicted, so right. You know, it's just like, okay, I'm back, you know, I don't know.
Oh, it's like getting a fix.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how I would view it.
In most of your classes, is it traditional where the professor lectures and the students are pretty silent and take notes, or is there a lot of interaction or innovative? What are you seeing in terms of teaching techniques?
I think students, well, my mom is a Montessori teacher, and it's hands-on. The children are allowed to choose whatever they want. They can come in barefoot. It's, like, completely free. So that style of learning is something I grew up with. But here in college, it's very suppressed. You know, people come in. The lights are really bright. You sit in your desk. People want the grade. They're not too focused on the learning. And in some of my classes, I'm a philosophy major. And that's discussion-based. Some of my classes, my professors are like, okay, let's get in a circle, let's get talking. And because we are so conditioned to sit still, to just adhere to the professor, we are kind of just like, we are just the subjects, the professor is in control. Students will even resist attempts to loosen it up. I remember my professor just stopped trying to get us to come in a circle and get lively because people were just so conditioned to just being, they just want to be fed stuff. They don't
or
always
or had they done the reading?
Maybe. They might have not done the reading, but I don't know. It's sad.
So overall, if you're going to give your Chico State 2 years here a grade for in terms of academic excellence, what grade would you give it?
Academic excellence, I'd say actually it's easier than my high school classes. Yeah,
less work, easy.
Oh yeah, it's like same level as probably my sophomore year in high school. So I don't know what grade that would be if I were to. I don't know. I don't want to be too harsh, but I know that's why I chose philosophy, because it's like reading really intense, hard stuff. And I'm taking metaphysics, and it's so hard. I don't even understand what's going on, but I like it because I'm like, okay, it's a challenge.
Who do you read in metaphysics?
Metaphysics, we read. Man, I don't even know all these philosophers. They're not
Wittgenstein.
No, they're not. They're contemporary, and they're not very famous. We read things on like free will, determinism, fatalism. Does time exist? Things like that. But in my more classic philosophy classes, we read like Sartre and
existentialists,
Kant, and yeah, things like Hume. Yeah.
And then, what do you think you'll? How will you use that philosophy major?
I really want to be a philosopher of race. I think that taking a philosophical lens towards issues like racism and sexism, all the isms, provides rationale, you know? Being racist doesn't make any sense. All you're doing is just projecting your biases onto some person and then making stuff up. There is nothing real about that. And I find that I've done like a few presentations on campus. I find that when I'm really like backing my arguments up with facts and referencing these like old white philosophers, people are like, okay, all right. So it's just like a tool for activism, I guess, for me.
And sounds like you're headed towards teaching.
Yeah, I'd love to be a professor. All my family, I come from a family of professors. All my grandparents are professors, and I would love to just like tell jokes to my students. They can't leave. Yeah, it sounds fun.
Oh, that's great. I've been working on books about global youth activism, and I'm really interested in generational differences. And Mike, what, you're 35?
30. Yeah, I'll be 35 next month.
So you're the Generation Y, kind of the older end, and you're Gen Y. Are you Gen Z? How old are you?
I'm 19. I don't know.
I think you're Gen Z.
Gen Z.
So you two are... I wonder how you think your generations are different from your parents' generations. Do you see any differences?
From my parents' generation?
Yeah.
I mean... I'm sure it is. I just can't pinpoint it just because of the... I don't know. I never really even thought about it.
Well, it seems like you're really different in that you're more interested in equality. You don't think the man is the total
boss of
the house.
Yeah, well, now that you gave me a little boost. Yeah, I mean, considering that, then most definitely. I mean, like I said, I was taught that, you know, the man works and the man... I don't feel like that at all. The men don't say I love you at home. Like, I give my daughter, like, 100 I love yous every day.
Aww.
You know, while we're sleeping, you know what I mean? Like, that's just who I am. I'm very loving, and I'm really, like, I'm free to express it in front of anybody and whoever wants to listen. It doesn't matter. You know, I tell all my friends at work I love them. You know what I mean? They're all men, big men. Yeah, I guess in that sense, yeah, we're completely different. You know, I share my feelings with anybody. I'm very emotional with my wife, like, and that my father and my mom, like, I never once seen him be emotional or kiss or anything, you know, which is, now that I think about it, it was kind of weird because I don't know where I got all these feelings. Maybe
because you're a human being.
Yeah, maybe.
Where'd they come from? Yeah.
I asked to feel my feelings, so I got to feel them all, I guess. No more numbing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and rehab can help with that.
Yeah.
How would you say you're different than your parents' generation?
I don't know. My
or
parents.
Gen X.
Gen X.
Probably.
My mom and dad, they went to school in the 90s, so. I don't know. I'm kind of seeing like a resurgence because, you know, in the 90s it was kind of a space for campus activism also, and like people waking up and being like, hey, this is not right. And I feel like that's what's happening now too. So I kind of see a lot of similarities, and my mom and I actually like discuss the same things, and we kind of do similar work. So I don't know. I think I'm lucky in a sense that my family, we're very like-minded. So I don't really see, like, a super stark difference.
And that's a characteristic of Gen Y and Z, is that they are close with their parents. Yeah. They don't see generational differences, where a baby boomer said, don't trust anybody over 30.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a generational characteristic. But you think people are waking up? Young people are waking up?
Definitely. I think we're in a transition period.
What do you mean? That's interesting.
Yeah. I think, there's this book, it's called Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and it talks about how both the oppressor and the oppressed suffer. So under racism, both white people and black people suffer, you know, and it's kind of weird to understand that, but I think now white people are being like, hey, wait a minute, the system is not right. This is affecting me, this is affecting everybody, it's hurting everyone, because we're looking up. So I think people are becoming more aware of that, and I don't know, they're making aims to stop it.
I'm really interested in the growing inequality and the emphasis on equality, and studies do show that more equal societies, people are happier.
Mm-hmm.
And in U.S. is very unequal.
Yes.
And people aren't as happy as they are in Scandinavia or places that really work for equality.
We're stuck in a cycle, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, but do you think people in your generation understand that we have to make change?
My generation, yes. And I think social media, honestly, is what does it. There's so much. You can do anything now. You have an idea. I have an idea. I tweet it. I'll get lots of retweets. I have people with similar minds that I can talk to. We can plan an event. My sister and I have planned protests in Oakland, and it happens immediately. So, I don't know. Similar mindsets are connecting at a faster rate, whereas, like, in the 60s, when people want to protest, send a letter and, you know.
Flyers.
Yeah, posters, flyers. Yeah. But now it's just so fast. Yeah.
Feel free to. What did you do the protest about?
We did a Black Lives Matter protest after the shooting of Philando Castile, but it was youth-oriented. So my sister was, like, the leader. She's 15, and she just invited youth from all of the local high schools and middle schools, and we marched around this lake in Oakland called Lake Merritt, and there was this like open forum space where people could speak and do poetry, and it was just so beautiful. It was just all young people, like younger than me, and I was like, man, when I wish I was doing stuff like that when I was that age, you know. So it was beautiful.
So you're saying that because of social media, it's easier for people to get the word out and organize quickly.
Planning protests on Instagram. That's what I use Instagram for a lot.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Do you have a protest in mind coming up?
My sister and I were trying to... She wanted to plan a protest for her birthday, but we were really trying to figure out what to specifically...